not asking for any.
Okay, we're bringing the meeting to order, the Public Safety Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. And looks like we've got a, we got a quorum. Let's count twice. What's the first order of business? So the first,
we have a quorum
now. Okay. Quorum being present, we'll take a roll. Mr. Sparby?
Chairman Cornish?
Here.
Vice Chairman Woodard?
Here.
Representative Mullery?
Here.
Representative Doubt? Representative Gauthier?
Here.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yep.
Representative Hilty?
Yep.
Representative Johnson?
Yep.
Representative Kelly?
Yep.
Representative Kiefer? Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Leidiger? Representative Mariani? Representative McDonald?
Here.
Representative Moran?
Here.
Representative Nornes?
Here.
Representative Slocum?
Okay, thank you. And then we, somebody move for the approval of the minutes for January 31st.
So moved.
Representative McDonald moves the minutes for January 31st. Any additions, corrections, complaints? Seeing none, so moved. All right. Now. All in favor of approval of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The
Thank you.
Is Representative McFarland in the audience here? There she is. This one we're just Representative McFarland, this is House File 1245. As noted in the bottom of our agenda, we've heard and passed this last year.
Right.
And it was returned to the committee. We'd like to move it back to the general register. Is that?
That's correct.
All right. Is any complaints on doing that? And Representative McFarland, did you want to say a few words about the bill?
Well, this is just including minors. Having it be unlawful to possess a firearm and be considered part of gang activity. You remember this from last year. I have Attorney John Choi here from Ramsey County if you needed him to speak to it. But I think
actually, it was my understanding we were just going to move this back. Okay. We didn't have to take any testimony. But, unless Mr. Choi would like to say a few words.
No, okay. He didn't need to, but he's ready. He's one.
Okay. We do note his presence here and thank him. Okay, any questions from the committee? So what the chair will move House File 1245, excuse me, to the general register is the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Lemire. Did I pronounce that right?
Yep.
All right. House File 1468, you understand the same drill here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, made it to the general register. And
did you want to say anything about the bill, Representative?
Sure. What the bill does, that we passed out of this committee last time, it allows law enforcement agencies to sell forfeitured firearms. Right now, they only have two options, which is to destroy the firearm or use it for training purposes. This just gives them that extra option.
All Okay, House File 1468, and if there's no objections, the chair will move House File 1468 back to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mayor. Members.
Okay. Representative Erickson, are you here today?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Good morning, Representative Erickson. The Chair will move House File 1844. If you go ahead with your presentation, Representative
Erickson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a dramatic change, probably, because I don't think this occurs in any other state. But if you notice the bill summary from House Research, this proposal makes it a misdemeanor for a victim protected under an order for protection or domestic abuse, no contact order, with intent to harass or retaliate against the abusing party, to invite the abusing party to the victim's dwelling or residence, knowing that such admittance is a violation of the order. And Mr. Chair, I have with me today Irene Benjamin, who would like to tell her story and who brought this concern to me, in spite of the fact that I've heard this concern over a period of years, where the person with the no contact order has been in communication with the abuser or whomever. So I'm hoping that you will listen intently to Mrs. Benjamin's testimony.
Okay, Ms. Irene Benjamin, is it? Go ahead, state your name, even though I already have for the record, and then say what you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Irene Wade Benjamin, and I am a member of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, and I'm enrolled at the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, located in central Minnesota. I am the mother of five adult men and grandmother of 11 beautiful grandchildren. Mr. Chairman and other representatives, while I read my statement here today, I would like you to keep in mind that I in no way condone any type of domestic abuse, being a victim myself many years ago. Also keep in mind that I am not trying to minimize the actions of anyone causing harm or fear towards another person. I am simply bringing attention to some of the problems regarding this law that I have become aware of through stories of some individuals, including members of my immediate family. My concern lies with the fact that when a person, usually male partner, is charged and convicted of the crime of domestic abuse, they're given an order to refrain from contacting the victim of their crime, known as the no-contact order. I have no argument with this. However, the problem that I'm concerned with is the victim is not held to the same standard of staying away from the perpetrator. This in itself can cause many more problems for the perpetrator, sending him back to jail and being further charged. The victim is not held accountable in any way. Let me give you a couple examples, if you would bear with me. A young man who has been charged with domestic abuse visits the Mille Lacs Indian Reservation, where he is an enrolled member. He is visiting at a friend's house. The victim in this case hitchhikes from the Red Lake Indian Reservation and goes to the house the perpetrator is visiting. The owner of the home has asked her to leave, as she has not been welcome there for a couple of years. The victim grabs the perpetrator's phone and a mug, throws the mug at the perpetrator, and runs out of the house. The perpetrator runs after the victim to retrieve his phone. Unbeknownst to him, she has dialed 911. The police do arrive, and the perpetrator is taken into custody. The police do not talk to the witness or the owner of the home. The police fail to Mirandize the perpetrator. The telephone that belongs to the perpetrator is not retrieved by the police from the victim. The perpetrator is then charged again for a second time, and the victim in the case, however, gets off from, number one, being in a house where she has been asked to stay away from months before, Number two, making a false police report. Number three, theft of another property, of another's property, because she did not return the phone to the perpetrator. Before the police placed the perpetrator in the squad car, the victim hollered several times, "He didn't do anything. He didn't hit me." Second scenario, a father becomes involved in a domestic dispute with the mother of his child. There is a no contact order in effect. Later, the victim contacts the perpetrator to babysit while she goes to work. She has no babysitter. Again, the victim knows very well that although she initiates the contact, she cannot be held accountable for not honoring the no contact order. The point I'm trying to make is, if we have created a revolving door system here. More often than not, the perpetrators return for many reasons, usually at the request of the victim, who is aware or has knowledge at least that there is a no contact order in effect. This may lead to other problems within that family circle. First and foremost, the children are placed in a position where their family loyalties are challenged, and they may have to make a decision who they love more or who they hate less. This is not fair to the child or the children. Also, with the high rate of unemployment throughout this country, it is hard enough to find employment without carrying a felony around with you. If one is convicted of violating a no-contact order for more than three times, it then becomes a felony. Our young fathers and mothers do not need this added barrier of gaining meaningful employment to become self-sufficient. I ask today that this body of government take into consideration the flaws of this no-contact stipulation, amend the domestic abuse law to refrain from punishing only the perpetrator when the no-contact order has been put in place and violated by both parties. It has become far too easy for the victim to have things her way by manipulating the perpetrator and the courts. Far too many fathers are suffering from this manipulation. I want to thank you for your time and your attention today in this matter. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Ms. Benjamin. And Representative Erickson, did you have any questions from the members, first of all, for the witness?
And Mr. Chair, I have no other witnesses.
Okay. Anybody out there that wish to testify in opposition to the bill? All right. Step up to the sit up to the microphone and give your name and title and your interest and begin. I'll drag up another chair, one of the pages.
No worries. Mr. Chairman, Joel Carlson. I represent the Coalition of Battered Women. Liz Richards is going to address the bill for us and others in law enforcement, and I appreciate the attention that you've given to this issue.
You bet. Ms. Richards, good to have you back. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Liz Richards. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We've just heard the testimony. I want to be perfectly clear that nobody wants protective orders to be used as tools of harassment or be used inappropriately. But we do have a number of concerns with the bill. I would first note that the order for protection and the domestic abuse no contact orders are important fundamental resources for victims of domestic violence. We do have a number of concerns with the proposed language in the bill. It will create problems for victims of domestic abuse, unintended consequences, I believe. It's also going to create some problems for law enforcement around enforcing these orders. Jim Franklin with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association is here if people want to delve into this in more detail. The County Attorneys Association, John Kingreath here as well, they have concerns about the bill. One thing that I would note, that if a respondent of a protective order is currently being harassed, there is already a remedy in law, and that would be to secure their own harassment restraining order to provide some protection for themselves. But the testimony that we've heard here, one of the things that we're committed to doing is taking that back to the Minnesota Criminal Justice Collaborative. This is a group that includes law enforcement, the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, the BCA, It includes the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. It includes Department of Public Safety, Office of Justice Programs, Department of Corrections, our agency, and the State Supreme Court. We will certainly take this back to the collaborative. The collaborative works on policy best practices issues. Certainly would take this back to them to see for discussion and consideration on this. We're willing certainly to talk to Representative Erickson to see if there's some better way to address the concerns that are being raised. But with the bill in its current format would be something that we would not support. We would ask you not to take action on the bill at this time.
Well, Ms. Richards, a question for me is, is there any way that you and the county attorneys or the attorneys and the Sheriff's Association can get together and find a solution rather than just concerns, because this does happen a lot, and just saying to them that they can go and get their own restraining order? You know more than anybody what a pain in the backside that that is, and a time consuming. It doesn't do much good right at the time, and so it is definitely a problem. It happens all the time, so I'm hoping you guys are interested in working with the author here in finding a solution for doing this, in an immediate solution, and not just saying, well, you know, go get your own order and that's all you can do.
Representative Cornish, absolutely will engage in conversations with Representative Erickson. I think what we're really concerned about is to make changes to a bill that has been around since 1979, that in most instances works very well, that's a critical tool, and to make a change that might not just address some specific incidences, but would also create a number of unintended consequences that could potentially gut the effectiveness of the bill itself. And so that's, we're certainly willing to look at this and see if there's a solution to legitimate issues that are out there, but we want to also make sure that we don't throw away a lot of the good that exists within the bill at the same time.
But I hear your concern. It's been my experience that judges are sometimes reluctant to go tit for tat and on these things, and when the already order out, then that person going back and finding the reasons to get an order after they've been either tricked to come in or baited to coming over or just made a mistake by coming over. So hopefully we can get this worked out. And Representative Slocum has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, doesn't one of the unintended consequences that I see immediately is, doesn't this give this change give abusers leverage with victims to possibly say, well, you know, they invited me, they can accuse the victim, or say that they falsely accuse a victim of inviting them, and does it not give the abusers some leverage? Can you elaborate a little bit about maybe some of the unintended consequences of this? That's one I see, and I'm sure there are others.
Ms. Richards?
Chair, Representative Slocum, I think you've touched on one potential. I mean, there are a number of problems, I think, in terms of how this is crafted, but one of the things that it does set up is the possibility that, because the wording in the bill as it sits, is that if a petitioner of a protective order invites somebody over, whether or not the respondent actually comes over, that creates the criminal action in and of itself. And there's some language about having to prove intent, which I think creates a lot of problems from a prosecutorial standpoint. And one of our fears is that what this might do is, well, create a liability for any victim of domestic violence who's a petitioner on one of these orders, because there's a lot of vagueness and looseness and very broad language in here. One of the things that we do know is that there are perpetrators of domestic violence who will manipulate systems and use manipulation as a tool, and this just appears to be one more potential place in which there could be manipulation. So those are some of the concerns about the way it stands right now.
Okay, any more questions? Representative Erickson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Not only during the time that I've served in the legislature, but before that, having been an abused wife myself, I have always been conscious of how important it is that the father or the husband also be part of the reconciliation and the mending of what has happened between the couple, whether married or not. And my husband and I were able to work out those differences over a long period of time. And that's what I'm so concerned about, is that we find ways to not just protect the mother and the children, which often is the case, but that we are also looking for ways to bring the father or the husband or the boyfriend into the reconciliation process. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I have in my heart a special way to relate to what Ms. Benjamin has just explained. And I think that's why she thought she could come to me and ask me to provide for this change in law. And maybe it's too severe, but I would hope that we could work on it and that Ms. Benjamin could be involved in this as well. And that others, perhaps, from a tribal land where I think this might be more frequently happening, although I've heard it across my district. So with that, Mr. Chair, I hope we can continue to work on this.
Okay, thank you, Representative Erickson. And Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Erickson, I'm glad to hear that you're willing to work on this, because I think it, I certainly appreciate the intent, and I'm sympathetic with that, but I think that as this is drafted, it has a number of problems, and one of them that perhaps you've thought about, and I'm interested in your response, is how would it be possible to establish that a violation had actually occurred? I mean, it seems to me that it would be very easy to falsely allege that an invitation has been issued, but it seems to me it would be kind of a rare circumstance in which it would actually be possible to prove that an invitation had actually been made.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilty. You know, the way that this is crafted is really the beginning of a conversation, and it seems around here that if we don't craft something that probably is a little bit more extreme, we don't get the conversation that can bring us back to probably a common sense answer. And so that's why I chose to go this direction. I was cautioned as I worked with others on this that, you know, there would be great opposition. And I said, you know, I'm willing to bear that because we have to start someplace. And if this weren't brought forward, how can we ever reach a common sense solution? And maybe there's not a solution, but maybe there is a solution in law, that is. But maybe there are other solutions that can be used as these Centers for Battered Women work with the families. And that's where my heart is.
Okay, Representative Johnson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I worked in law enforcement and dealt with domestic abuse for 35-plus years, and I just think it's worth noting that, you know, domestic abuse, family dysfunction is very complicated, and it's not always easy to discern issues. But I will say it is clear, and was clear to me, that there's not a sense of parity or equalness between the abusing party and the victim, that there is clearly more manipulation and issues in terms of supervising and issues of violence on the part of the abusers, the abusing party's role. So I don't want to give the sense that this is an equal thing where the victim and the abusing party are kind of equally at blame for what's going on here. That is not the case. We need to be clear that there's an abuser and there's a victim, and any legislation that moves forward needs to reflect that. This, at this point, certainly does not.
Okay, Ms. Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand and I appreciate what everybody is saying here today, you know, the perpetrator versus the victim, and how do we discern, you know, who's right and who's wrong. I think that, I know in talking with tribal police a couple of times when this has happened on the reservation, and I, you know, brought to the attention the mother does not even live in this area, or the victim or the lady or whatever, she doesn't even live in this area. So how is he being, you know, the only one that's being held accountable here? She came into this area. And I think that our police officers are very well trained and being able to discern that. Like they said, we understand what you're saying, Irene. You know, she has crossed the boundary, she has crossed the limits, she has violated, but it was not her order. It was the order for him. And it just didn't make sense that she, you know, was the one who initiated the contact, and yet, you know, she's gone scot-free. And again, like I said, I can appreciate what everybody's saying here, but I think that the police officers themselves are trained well enough to know what is going on. If you're a true victim and you're really afraid of your perpetrator, you're going to call the police before that person even gets into your home, versus if that perpetrator has been in your home for any length of time.
We have Representative Keither and then Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Benjamin, it's interesting, you mentioned in your testimony that sometimes a mom will call the abuser to babysit her children. I'm just really surprised by that. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable asking an abuser to watch my children. Can you explain that a little bit more? And then I have a follow-up.
Ms. Benjamin?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to address that comment from Representative Keither. This incident is happening today in my family. My grandson's mother, there is an OFP out, and he goes over there to babysit because she has no other babysitter when she has to work on weekends. And I tell him all the time, be careful, you got that OFP, you got that, you know. But the mom says, nope, I didn't mean to put that OFP against him. I'm, you know, we're not going to have no problems. My son is caught between a hard place and a rock. He's got an OFP against him, no contact order, but yet he has the child there who needs a babysitter and a mom who needs to go to work. You know, and so it's all them types of things that we have to take into consideration. It's happening, and not only with my son, but with other families out there. Where there's, at the moment, you know, they're in this unhealthy situation, and then out of their passion or fear or, you know, whatever feeling they're feeling at the time, you know, you get this the police involved, and then later on everything is qualmed over, and then the family goes back to normal. And we have to take that into consideration, too. I'm not talking about, again, like I said, I don't condone abusive behavior. I was a victim myself at an early age. But I think we can't punish everybody across the board. And I think that we have to put some of this in the police officer's hands, because they're out there. They see it. They know what's going on. And in smaller communities where I come from, the police officers know who are the batterers and who are not, and who...
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. I think we can get a picture of what's going on. I'm sorry, I forgot your name on the end.
Liz Richards.
Okay, Ms. Richards. Are the people, and I'm just going to say men, but I know this could be for women. I don't want to give anyone unequal treatment here. But do the men know the rule? So if the woman that he battered calls him and says, come over, he is well informed of the rules that he really should not go over there, even though she's called him and asked him to.
Chair, Representative, I would, two responses to this. One is that the language is clear on the face of an order. The uniform form has actually an all bold caps information that says that even if there is an invitation to go to the property, the petitioner is not in violation of the order, and that the order still is in full effect. So, and as a typical rule, it's often, the actual language on the order form says you're forbidden to enter or stay at the petitioner's residence for any reason, even if invited to do so. The petitioner is not in violation of this order, and the order is not canceled if the respondent is found at the petitioner's residence. That's in bold caps on every form. And typically the court will talk at hearings about the conditions of the order. I would also note that particularly when children are involved, there are remedies both within the domestic abuse order for protection proceedings and within family law itself to make arrangements for how parenting time between the parties is structured, how those exchanges happen. Those remedies already exist within the family court in the protective order laws. And while I'm certain that there are individual instances where these are not dealt with well within those orders, the tools are there within the laws already, and it seems a fairly extreme step to create a criminal penalty where there may be a better way to use what we currently have on the books.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A comment first and then a question for Ms. Richards. Domestic violence in relationships is very complicated, and there's no real simple solution. Having worked with batterers and victims for many, many years, and I've seen both sides of this coin, so it is complicated. So my question to Ms. Richards and perhaps to Representative Erickson, what would be wrong when there's a request for an OFP that there be a mutual OFP, that would be the tendency of the court to look at that first, and then all parties are held accountable? So that's my question.
Ms. Richards?
That it be a mutual OFP automatically.
Chair, Representative, a couple of things around, and I want to be clear about what you mean by a mutual order for protection. Mm-hmm. What's typically meant in the legal sense when we talk about mutual order for protection is that a petitioner comes in, files for the request, and they fill out the petition, the affidavit, it's filed, there's a due process that has to be followed around that. And if a respondent shows up at the hearing and merely makes the request to have an order on their behalf as well, those are not to be issued. And that's both under case law and also under the Federal Violence Against Women Act, that if those orders are issued by the state, they don't get full faith and credit under those provisions. And the reason for that, but that's distinct from if a petitioner files the paperwork, alleges domestic abuse as defined under the statute, and the respondent is served with that, the respondent, if they believe they also are the victim of domestic abuse, they are perfectly within their rights to file their own petition. Those can be heard at the same time by the court, but it meets all the due process requirements. The court considers each of those on their own merits, and the court can and does issue order for protections both directions. Yeah. Those are distinct from what's typically referred to as mutuals. Okay.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Go ahead, Mr. Representative Guthrie.
Ms. Richards, then trying to find solutions here, and Representative Erickson, could there not, if I was, for example, being served with an OFP, could there not be notification that I have a right to do that at the same time? Because I don't always know if people know their rights, and I don't always know that attorneys convey those rights. And I want to be real clear here. I understand the power relationships. I understand that there is no equality in that relationship, and abusive behavior is unacceptable at any time by anybody. But I want to be clear about that. But it seems to me if we're trying to find a remedy, that maybe a notification, and then the court can sort that out, yes or no. So your feedback on that.
Let Representative Erickson wants to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for that question. California, Colorado, Massachusetts, and I know South Carolina and South Dakota and Washington all have something in regard to mutual protection. There are varying levels for which it is allowed. And so that might be something that we could look at, but I really appreciate your bringing that up because that most state law is silent on this issue, but those are the exceptions. Thank you.
Just for the committee and the witnesses, edification. Your Royal Honor, the chair is considering holding this bill over or laying it over for further consideration, and we could easily debate this, I think, for another hour. But so I think it's a good time to, unless somebody really has a desperate need to testify and say something that hasn't been said already, if the author would mind if we just lay this bill over for further consideration, and hopefully the other parties will work with you in finding a solution to this. So.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair,
and we'll committee. Lay the bill over. Thank you very much. And thank you, Ms. Benjamin, for...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Representative Vogel. Representative Vogel, you have a House File 1899. The chair will move that bill, and I understand that you have a author's amendment to put it in the shape you'd like it to be in, or not?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And what's the number of that amendment?
There's no amendment.
It's an oral amendment.
Oh, that's just an oral amendment to strike a whole section, right?
Strike section 2, yes. That's for that.
Okay.
And then also on page 2, line 2.5, we would like to just change after victim of, we'd like to strike A and put an alleged crime. So.
Hey, Mr. Peeble or Ms. Pierce, could you restate that amendment? Strike section 2, and then what was the second one? Could you?
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would be to House File 1899, delete Section 2, and also on page 2, line 5, delete A and insert an alleged.
Okay. The chair would move that amendment. Any discussion on... Okay, the chair moves the amendment as stated to strike Section 2 and then the as described by Ms. Pierce in 2.5. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Vogel, why don't you explain the bill and what you just did and how it changes it in the new form?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. What we've done is in striking Section 2, it alleviates the responsibility on law enforcement and they're tracking down and locating a parent or guardian or person of custody of a minor in the case of a abuse situation, sexual abuse or whatever. So that's basically what it is doing. It's just eliminating that responsibility on them.
Okay, Representative Vogel, did you want to, who would want to present the bill, your witness?
I have a witness. I'd like to have Sarah just talk a little bit about this. This stems from an incident that happened to her down in Lyon. So.
Is Ms. Guzenberg, is that how you pronounce it?
Guzenberg.
Okay. State your name, even though I already did, and go ahead with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sarah Guggetsberg, and I live in Clare City. I am Jacob's mother. My husband and I were divorced in 2001. I received full custody of the three children we shared together, and we shared joint legal custody. I was their primary caregiver. Throughout the years, the kids would go visit their father on weekend visitations. In 2005, during the spring and summer, when Jacob was just 5 years old, he was sexually abused by a neighbor of his father's. Through the investigation, my son's name came up, and investigators over from Lyon County Sheriff's Department talked to my ex-husband. They told him they thought Jacob had been abused. My ex-husband chose not to do anything, chose not to allow Jacob to be interviewed, did not tell me, and he did not tell Jacob that he knew about the abuse. On Easter Sunday of 2009, 4 years later, during Child Abuse Awareness Week at school, Jacob told a social worker that he was abused. That Easter Sunday, he told me, I called Chippewa County Sheriff's Department. They sent out a deputy who took Jacob's statement. We then called Lyon County and spoke to the same investigator who handled the case in 2005. I later talked to that investigator just a week later and shared with him what Jacob had shared about a very G-rated version about what had happened to him. And to my surprise, the investigator told me he already knew. I didn't know. Jacob lived with me. Nobody told me. The investigator then shared with me that they had spoke to Mike, and Mike wished not to do anything at all. And it stayed there because legally and by statute, they contacted a parent. I was given full custody of the kids because I showed that I was a better parent to make these sorts of choices for the children. In April of this last year, 2011, we immediately put Jacob into counseling right after the 2009 when he came out. In April of 2011, Jake was having a lot of issues with the sexual abuse that he endured. Finally, he told me everything that had happened to him. It wasn't a G-rated version anymore, it was X-rated. It was horrible. Later that week, Jacob tried to take his own life. I took him to the emergency room, and we took him to Fargo to a crisis center for the week. On the way home, I asked Jacob, what's the worst part about your abuse? And he says, when his abuser made him stand outside the door and guard the door while he raped other children. Nobody talked to Jacob. Who are these other children? I don't know. Maybe if they would have talked to Jacob in 2005, we would know who these other children are. So when I got home in April of 2011 after the Fargo stay, I called the investigator again and I said, Tony, more happened. He said, I know. I said, what do you mean you know? I spoke to him, remember, in April of 2009, and I gave him my phone number. I said, if anything else comes up, call me. Please tell me. I don't think Jacob is telling us everything. 2 months later, according to the reports, this investigator received a full confession from Jacob's abuser, from social services. The abuser was trying to get out of the treatment facility that he was being held in, but he couldn't pass a lie detector test. He told of everything that he did to my son and three other children. I never got a phone call 2 months after the original April 2009 report that we made. Again, a week later, my son tried killing himself, and two more times within the next month, he tried to take his own life. He couldn't handle it. He needed some sort of services right away. He kept a secret for how many years, and it really wasn't a secret. It was a secret that he thought he had, and something I didn't know. I would have got him counseling right away. Social services was never told about this. They would have came in and they would have offered us services. They would have interviewed all the children. And the children could have began healing back then. But instead, I'm picking up the pieces of a broken little boy that had been shattered over the last 6 years.
Okay, Mrs. Guggisberg, thank you very much. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, with this legislation, what we are trying to do is simply prevent this case scenario from happening again. And what we have done is we are adding to what the custody order is for a judge in a divorce situation. And that's on page 2, basically lines 2 through 6, or 2-4 through 2-6. It's just telling the court that they need to, each party needs to notify the other in a case that a minor child becomes a victim of a crime, an alleged victim. So that way both parents or guardians or whoever's in charge has responsibility for the children are made aware of the situation so that a responsible decision can be made. Also, The final section on section 3, line C, we're also just adding that if a child is the victim of an alleged crime under paragraph A, that the law enforcement agency shall notify the local welfare agency so child services can immediately get involved. So we believe that Child Services, once they get involved and if they're notified, they will begin the process of interviewing, counseling, and whatever needs to be done to help that situation out. So, and I understand that most law enforcement agencies already do the notification, but because this crime occurred outside of the home and not in the home, there's just that loophole in the law that this fell through. So we just want to try to correct that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel, I think your intent is good. I think the testimony we heard today was horrific, and I can understand the motivation. But we also just had testimony about orders for protection, and your bill would require someone to violate an order. So that, I think, is something that you need to consider. And also, if people are in protective custody and are hiding, your bill requires them to expose themselves to that. So those are the concerns I have for your bill.
Mm-hmm. Representative Vogel, did you have anybody else want to testify in support of your bill?
I do know that we talked with county attorneys, the sheriff's department, and the police chiefs association, and they are all in favor of the bill as it stands. We do have MnCASA, and I am working with MnCASA, but Caroline, don't remember her last name, I think would like to come up and just testify a little bit. But we are going to be working with MnCASA to try to address the issue that Representative Gauthier talked about. We're asking that the bill from here goes to Judiciary Committee, so we will be working on that between now and then to try to address any concerns that would be raised there.
Mr. Chair. Palmer, you state your name and title and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We're a statewide coalition. We represent about 70 sexual assault advocacy programs around the state. And I would like to thank Representative Vogel for our conversations that we've had with him and the work we've done on the bill so far. We did have concerns about the bill initially, and we worked with a number of different groups, including other victim advocacy organizations. We talked to law enforcement. We talked to the County Attorneys Association. And the concerns that were raised by the representative are ones that we still have, just with regard to how protective orders would come into play. And I'll just briefly name a couple of concerns, and it is my understanding from Representative Vogel that we will continue to iron these out. But yes, exactly, we wanted to address the issue of whether or not a parent would be placed in the position of violating a protective order, and we also wanted to look at situations where the child is the subject of the protective order. We wanted to look at situations where a parent or family is in the Safe at Home program. We also wanted to look at situations where there might be a statutory bar to custody where one of the parents might have a history of a violent crime. So we just have a number of issues we would like to continue to work on with Representative Vogel and to address some of those concerns that you have raised, and it's my understanding that we can continue to have the conversations. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Palmer. Any questions from the committee? Is there anybody else that wishes to testify, or Representative Vogel, any closing statement before we move the bill?
No, Mr. Chair, I just thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I just recommend that we pass it to Judiciary, that you would do that, and we'll continue to work on clarifying some of these issues.
Okay, Representative Vogel, the Chair would move House File 1899 as amended to be recommended to pass and move to the Judiciary Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative Vogel, and thank you, Guggisberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Okay, we have the hearing some questions about the from the Public Safety Division, the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, Department of Public Safety, and we have two testifiers, Michelle Tuckner, the new director of Alcohol and Gambling, and Mary Ellison, the deputy commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Did you want to both come up together? Or? Okay, Director Tuckner and Commissioner Allison, you probably both know why you're here. Just for some background, when I met with you, the Commissioner, I asked that when you came here, we realized that this has been going on for some time. We have a new director, a former Major Tuckner of the Patrol?
Lieutenant Colonel.
What's that?
Lieutenant Colonel, sir.
Lieutenant Colonel. Sorry, I demoted you there. And we had asked that even though we knew that we just didn't get an answer that, well, that happened before our time, we'll have to go back and a lot of things like we wanted to do some research before you got here. And we've got a whole litany of questions, as you can imagine. What we'd like to do is have you start out, and you probably anticipated some of the questions, and that'll help us out a lot. If you can answer them, we can check them off of our list, and then some of them might have to be re-asked or modified or whatever. But if you could go ahead however you want to proceed and give us an explanation in keeping in mind the auditor's report from back a number of years ago and the recent newspaper articles, if you can bring as much light onto the subject as what is perceived out there by the public as a real failure to inspect these casinos and their operations. So go ahead however you wish, and welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Michelle Tuckner. I am the director with Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement. Can you hear me okay?
If we could turn that volume up a hair, that would be great. But
I'll kind of yell a little bit here. I am the director of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement. Thank you for inviting us here today to come and talk about our division. My understanding is some of the questions that were asked initially by the chair was that we provide a brief overview of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. And we'll cover that as well as what the division does, and then try to touch on the casino inspections and then what we might have for the future. I'm going to touch briefly on just a few slides about the overall staffing and responsibilities of AGED as a whole. We call it AGED, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. We'll touch on our staffing, the roles and responsibilities, what we've been doing with inspections, and what the future is. Our AGED staff consists of 21 people. We have 7 sworn agents, that includes myself. 3 agents and 1 supervisor are assigned to gambling. 1 agent and 1 supervisor are assigned to our previous Min Scams lottery fraud program. We have 4 alcohol investigators. 1 alcohol.
It might be a cell phone if everybody can shut theirs off.
I'm sorry. 1 alcohol investigations trainer, 7 staff that handle all the licensing and fingerprint checks for all the alcohol and gambling enforcement. Roles and responsibilities. AGED conducts background investigations, criminal investigations relating to lawful gambling. We do this for 3 state entities, the Minnesota State Lottery, the Gambling Control Board, and the Racing Commission, and we do that as part of the Paramount Mutual horse racing tracks and the card rooms. We investigate those fraud scams. We do background investigations for all of those entities as well as for tribal gaming. We investigate illegal gambling. We enforce laws pertaining to the illegal gambling, such as bookmaking. We monitor alcohol from manufacturer to the public. We issue both the alcohol and the gambling licenses, and we define and approve the regulatory processes as well. We provide a significant amount of time doing technical and field assistance to the businesses and local units of government. We have a lot of contact with the cities and the counties related to alcohol licensing and gambling with the tribes. Then lastly, we initiate enforcement activities. We resolve and mediate complaints on liquor and gambling violations. We conduct hearings on violators and provide forums for discussion on those subjects as well. I have two more slides on the roles and responsibilities, and then we can move to the other. Alcohol. We maintain the integrity of the alcohol beverage industry by providing consistent regulation and enforcement as it relates to alcohol licensing, sales, importation, distribution, and education. We collect, verify, and approve records, and we act as a repository for over 21,500 liquor licenses and permits. We conduct liquor license inspections. We did about 420 last year, and we field liquor industry and advertiser inquiries over 1,000 a year. We provide training on alcohol awareness issues, on licensing procedures, on liquor laws, and on regulations. We provide that to the alcohol servers as well as to city government officials and city clerks. And we investigate and conduct criminal investigations of alcohol-related complaints. We investigate tax-delinquent licensees buying alcohol from illegal sources, and we investigate illegal alcohol promotions. Let me go back. On the gambling side, we perform background investigations and criminal investigations relating to lawful gambling. We investigate and enforce the laws related to illegal gambling, such as illegal sports wagering and the wealth, fraud scams. We perform background checks, fingerprint checks, and we do that on behalf of the tribal casinos, the lottery, the Gambling Control Board, again, and the Racing Commission for their racetracks and their card rooms. And lastly, we do conduct Class 3 slot and blackjack gaming inspections at the state tribal casinos, and that's under the authority of the compacts. This table is a table about what those three agents assigned to gambling right now and their one supervisor, what duties they have. They're responsible to provide services to all of the state entities, the Gambling Control Board, the lottery, and the Racing Commission, and the tribes. These are the same agents that are assigned to those 18 casinos. You can see from the table above what they did last year. We have a substantial number of illegal gambling complaints. We had 88 illegal gambling complaints. We had 32 violations of lawful gambling. There's a significant amount of their time is spent handling those investigations. We also do backgrounds for all of those entities. Backgrounds can take anywhere from a month to over a year. We're currently performing two backgrounds right now. One is with a company in Germany, and one is with a company in Japan, and they stretch over a very long period of time. So those are some of the responsibilities they perform as well. So you can see from the table here that there was over 204 different types of investigations or crimes that were being researched and investigated by these three agents. Those are the three that were spoken of that also do the casino inspections. I'm just going to give a brief highlight on the compacts. They were signed in 89 and 91. 89 was the slots, and 91 was the blackjack. There's no expiration or sunset date. They remain in effect until they're renegotiated or replaced. Both the state and tribal government must mutually agree to negotiate before any changes to the compacts can be made. There is an opportunity for technical amendments, but they can only address technology advances to the games that exist currently. AGE does have the right to monitor and inspect Class 3 games for compliance with the compacts. And our state's, the AGE's jurisdiction is limited. Some people think we can fine, cite, or suspend, and that is not the case. We do not have that authority. We're asked that quite often. I'm going to touch briefly on this, and then we can try to answer questions about the inspections themselves. But people ask, well, what happens if you find something that's not in compliance? So I've kind of created a simple flow chart. We perform an inspection. And when there can be one of two outcomes, on the right side of the table, the inspections reveal compliance and there's no further action taken. Or the inspection reveals some non-compliance. If that's the case, the tribes can accept our findings and take appropriate corrective action. If they don't, they can dispute our findings. If they dispute our findings, the compact allows for an independent testing lab to come in and review what our findings are. If the independent testing lab rules that our assessment is correct, they can take corrective compliance, take corrective action, we can have compliance. If they choose still not to take corrective action, then we're left with either bringing it before a federal court or the National Indian Gaming Commission. And just for the record, when we have uncovered issues in the past, they've always been very cooperative and worked with us. We've not had to take that other route. AGE performs random and periodic inspections of blackjack tables and slot machines. Over the last 6 years, they've conducted approximately 667 inspections. That averages 111 a year. They have declined. They have simply declined. There were no inspections in 2011. But the previous inspections have revealed in the past were minor or infrequent issues that did not affect the play of the machine. And by that, what we mean is there was no harm to the playing public. It wasn't related to the payouts. Typically, they were mechanical meters that would fail. The mechanical meter was the third backup of a system of counting coin in and coin out. Since that time, there's been a technical amendment that's removed the requirement for that because there are two other methods of how to capture that data. When we did find issues in the past, casino management did take corrective action. I understand, AGE understands, the concerns that the legislature and the public has, and I take that responsibility very seriously of maintaining the integrity of gaming. I came into this position on October 3rd. I spent a significant amount of time reading the legislators' audit report of 2005 from cover to cover. I've met with my staff. I've begun to meet with industry folks about all of AGED's issues. And it didn't take long for me to recognize that we needed a strategic plan. AGED has a very large responsibility of two of the most multi-billion dollar industries in Minnesota, alcohol and gambling. I see areas for improvement in both. I need to step back and take a big picture. I need to involve the legislature, the public, the industry folks, other law enforcement, other state entities to determine what our priorities need to be. I need to look at all our statutory responsibilities, and I need to determine how to balance that with the priorities and requests of everyone's needs and determine what that plan needs to be. Ironically, that process started last Friday. We held our first meeting. I've been in touch with the facilitator to start that process. I feel I need to take that step because there are many responsibilities, and I need to make certain that we cover those that are the most important and balanced and that we hit all the points, and I don't want to do a knee-jerk reaction. However, in that time, since I've been here, what I've started to do is to analyze our staffing needs. In the chart that showed our staffing, you'll see that there were two vacancies. I took note of the auditor's report and determined that maybe what we need isn't sworn officers. Maybe we need something different. So I'm looking at our staffing needs and trying to determine what would best fulfill those needs for doing both inspections on the alcohol and on the gambling side. Our technology is outdated. It's no excuse. We'll get it up. But right now we're looking at the technology we have and how we can make those improvements. We have some very bright agents, and recently one of them had made some recommendations on how we can review the pay-in and payout, which is the most common question we get is the machine paying out properly? Determine the method to use technology to be able to review by looking at a slot report in the period of less than 2 hours if those payouts are correct. We've started that process with one of the tribes already, as was noted in one of the articles, and we will continue that with other casinos as well. We recently received a letter from one of the tribes about the financial audits now being ready for review. We've already sent off a letter and asked to have a meeting to set up to review those financial audits. I take that seriously, and once a year we will review those audits. I do have an agent that has a background in accounting, and we will do our best to look at those and see what we can determine. And last is determining best practices. When I came in this division, I came from the State Patrol. I didn't know anything really about alcohol and gambling. I spent the last 3 months reading and learning everything I possibly can about this division. But in the patrol, one of the things I learned about was networking and finding others that know things. I've been in contact with the director of the Wisconsin Gaming Division. I've gotten a copy of their procedures manual. We've reached out to Nevada and other states that have significant gaming, and I'm trying to determine what are those best practices. What reasonable standards can we set here for Minnesota? So those are the steps that I've taken at this time so far, and what our intentions are as we continue to move forward. I suspect that I've not answered all your questions about the casino inspections, and I think at this time, unless Commissioner Ellison has something, I would be happy to take those questions now.
Just so you know, the chair's intent to be my intent to let Miss the commissioner say anything as she like, and then I would like to, if Mr. Nobles is willing, to bring him up to the grilling table and ask him a few questions before we take members questions from the members. That way we get much information out there and check as many off of our lists as we can here. So, Commissioner, would you like to say a few words?
Mr. Chair, remember,
noted that probably the scrutiny on you would be a little greater on the Director Tuckner because she has the excuse she didn't have any part of this in the past. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly why I'm here. Director Tuckner is new. You can see she's extremely competent and approaching this in just the right fashion. I just, in terms of context, I know you don't want to hear excuses, and I'm not here to provide excuses. However, I do want to point out one thing, and that is that since I did, you know, I was part of the prior administration, and now I've carried over into the current administration, the legislature did reduce the budget for alcohol and gambling by $100,000 in the 2009 session that impacted the budget for 2010 and 2011. And in consideration of the budget reductions that year, this committee, it was a different makeup of the committee, different makeup of the legislature, but this committee did ask me to come and talk about the potential impact of budget reductions. And I did testify that one of the impacts of the budget reductions that we would have to curtail inspections of video games of chance at tribal casinos. So I just want to point that we haven't been trying to be opaque or not transparent. We did testify that that would be the result of some of the budget cuts. Again, that's not to excuse the fact that we need to do more. I think that the agency recognized that we needed to do more in this area by hiring Director Tuckner and asking her to do a strategic plan and look at the proper deployment of resources within her division. So with that, I'll just stand for questions.
Okay, and we'd like to hold those questions till Mr. Nobles, would you appreciate if you could come down and what I'd kind of like you to address, and you can ad lib too if you'd like, but you've heard the testimony. I would like you to think about the report that was done before a number of years back and consider what has been done since then. And in your opinion, is it a good excuse if you cut the budget $100,000? The lack of the inspections, I mean, in FTEs, and how many FTEs, if you address that in your report that they should have in this, and why the difference in the inspections number of other organizations in this one. But go ahead, if you would. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm a legislative auditor. And just to step back for a minute, I think you all know this, but we did this evaluation 7 years ago looking broadly at all of the various state responsibilities for gambling oversight and regulation. And so, as you know, and I think you have a copy of it, there's a chapter on the Department of Public Safety's work and specific references to the work they do at the casinos. And first of all, I think what I just heard was a very good, at least beginning, dialogue between this committee and the legislature generally and the department. Because I think what you heard, and you probably hear this a lot, that agencies, and you expect this of them, to set priorities, and sometimes they struggle to do that in terms of their allocation of resources. But I agree with you, and I think most of us here, that where we have clear legal responsibilities, particularly those related to the protection of the public, we need to find a way to accomplish those responsibilities. I think our biggest concern when we looked at this activity and the way it was being carried out, that we thought that they just needed a much more, frankly, sophisticated approach. You know, gambling for what we used to call slot machines, I guess, has changed dramatically. They used to be basically mechanical machines, and now they are electronic with computer systems in them. And we felt that from what we saw, that it was not simply a matter of the number of times that agents were there, but it was what they were doing when they got there. And so I was, frankly, pleased to hear that the new director read our report as a part of her orientation into her new responsibilities, and that she is considering the possibility that they need both a new strategy, but also
possibly an upgrading of the skills of the people that go into the casinos and do this. The only other thing I would add, Mr. Chairman, and I think you're certainly aware of this, as it is certainly portrayed in our report, it is a somewhat more complex regulatory environment for the state. There is a federal presence for Indian gaming, and basically the state's authority is outlined in the compact. And so it isn't as subject to the kind of amendment strengthening that you might prefer from a state point of view. Again, we are very bound by the negotiations that occurred that resulted in the compact between the tribes and the state and others that were involved. So you're working within a somewhat more rigid legal framework. Frankly, that was true even for the work we did. We had to negotiate our way into the casinos to do our evaluation work. The tribes do not fall as sovereign entities under the jurisdiction of the legislative auditor, and yet we were able to go into the tribes and look not only at what was being done by the agents, but look behind the scenes at what we thought they could be looking at but weren't. So, Mr. Chairman, that's my overview. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Well, why we've got you up here is with, rather than drag you back later, Representative, did Creasle want one here? Is this it? Representative Ledecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I may have several questions, but and this, I think, is a question that falls within your purview, and that is in the inspection that you do. And you talked about going from the mechanical to the electronic. Is it true then that you can actually set differing payouts on the slot machines? That in fact there are settings on there that you know, that somebody can go in and actually change them so that they would pay out more or pay out quite a bit less? And of course, let me just set the stage here. You know, we're looking at an organization that, from what we can see, isn't even looked at. We're talking 20,000 of these machines in the state, of which almost anything can happen, and nobody watches what's going on. So, the first question is, can these machines be changed in terms of payout?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidinger and others. Yes, I mean, they're programmed. They're computer programmed in various ways, and one of the ways is to deem when payouts are occurred and in what rate. So can somebody change that? Yes, they can. That's why there should be security around those systems, and those should be looked at. One of the things that we referenced in our report is, and again, this is given the nature of who we were looking at, referenced in our report, is, and again, this is given the nature of who we were looking at, namely the tribes, and they're running a business. It clearly is in their interest to ensure that there are controls around who has access to the computer programs beyond just the machines themselves, although you do want to control security access into each and every machine. But you also want security in the back room, in the servers that have the programs that drive the systems, to ensure that internally within the operation of the casino, you don't have inappropriate access. And so there are interests on the part of the tribe to ensure that they don't have people, to put it bluntly, stealing money from them. Casinos always have that concern. If you go into any kind of gambling operation, one of the most present forms of control and security is to prevent internal theft and fraud against the business operations. But you also have a concern, you should, to protect the public as well. I don't know if that fully answered your question, but I think, you know, in short, yes, they are programmed by a computer system, and just like any other computer system, that is subject to change.
Can I just follow up a little bit?
Representative Ledger.
Now, is that each individual machine then is changed, or is it really it's done in the server room? so they'll so then can they program differing payouts on the different machines? And is that and just to go further, is that something then that is to be inspected? Is it an easier inspection, for instance, that you would just have to inspect the programming in the servers, or do you actually have to go and inspect and in each individual machine?
Mr. Noble? Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger and others, well, I wouldn't want to extend beyond my knowledge because, I mean, yes, we have a number of casino operations and they may operate differently. But you, as I said, from our point of view and what we saw in the operations that we examined, the agents were mostly looking, in some cases exclusively looking at individual machines, and we thought that they should go deeper into the systems that drive those machines. There are certain security devices, both electronic and mechanical, on individual machines that should be maintained. But there is also, again, server computer programming that should be examined more thoroughly than we found they were.
Mr. Leiter,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this, not only should these individual machines be inspected, but certainly the systems, and your recommendation is to certainly look at everything. is there a requirement that the casinos must post what their payouts are on each individual machine? You know, it seems like the whole regulation is pretty loose. I mean, are they supposed to have some sort of a posting on what a typical payout would be at each casino, or how you would do it on each machine, or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, we may be venturing beyond my expertise. Okay. And again, I think it would simply reflect the difference in the legal structure that would be, for example, under the lottery system, the state lottery, that would be very much subject to your control under state law, which is in fact the case there's certainly a number of public postings that have to occur for the lottery. I don't think state law extends in any way into the casinos at that level of detail, however. So you'd have to ask both the casino operators, possibly public safety, about what under the compact and federal law is required.
Before you take any more questions, we've got to be mindful. We've got to be out of here before noon because session starts at noon. Representative Leidiger, go ahead.
But just my last comment really is it's clear that we fall quite a bit short, and I'm basing it on the audit report, that oversight regulation is falling way short from what it should be, that there seems to be huge areas within the casino operations that are not even being looked at, much less just the minimal amount, I can't even call it the minimal amount, what's occurring now and, of course, what has occurred in the past, and the lack of any inspection, essentially, in the last 4 years. So I'll just yield to other questions.
Thank you, Representative Leidiger. Representative Woodard, McDonald, and Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Nobles, I am impressed that we finally got into a line of questioning that you may not have an expertise on, because I think you're an expert on everything in this state. But I do have some questions about the budget. And so this may be for the director and the assistant commissioner. But my understanding is that the tribes are required to pay a fee in order for us to do these inspections. Is that correct?
I'm sorry. I was stepping up. I didn't hear what you said.
Yeah, that's okay. So are the tribes paying a fee for these inspections today? Is there an account that they're paying into, or is this all out of our general fund dollars when we do these inspections?
Director Tucker.
We receive from each tribe yearly $13,363, I believe it is, from each tribe, but that's for the blackjack compact, or it's written into the blackjack compact that's what they pay. The fees that you might be referring to is when they do typical fingerprint checks they pay a fee into an account to us to run those background or fingerprint checks, depending upon what we're doing for them. So I'm not quite sure which account you might be referring to.
Representative Woodard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually referring to, I think, the 13,000 plus number you were looking at. And that's specifically for blackjack inspections. How many blackjack inspections have we done in the last 4 years? Were you able to kind of tie that out versus what we were doing on the slot machines?
Director Tucker.
Mr. Chair, representatives, from what I've seen is the same information that you have. It looks like in 2010, I believe it was, they went out and did a number of blackjack inspections. I think it was 27 at the time. In significance to the number of casinos, it doesn't sound like a lot. I need to dig deeper to find out how that was managed and what was done. It seems to be short.
Okay. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to keep this short. But you testified that today there's no procedures manual, correct, that you've reached out to Wisconsin to get an idea of what they're up to?
Mr. Chair, representatives, actually there's procedures manuals for the inspection of the slots. They have, I wouldn't call it a manual, they have some database, computer-based things that they use for doing inspections for blackjack. But I would perceive having a much larger procedures manual that would address a more full inspection of a casino. And I'm very interested. I did get a copy of Wisconsin's. It's quite large. I haven't read through it all yet. But I think it might be helpful to have procedures for everything. And I'm not certain that I've found that in this division yet. That I found pieces here and there, but not quite a complete manual. Even if we do, it might be time to review and update that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just one final follow-up question, and because I'm really, I've got lots of questions, but I'll try to limit it to this last one here. And one comment, Director, I'm very impressed with what you're doing as well. I would echo what Mr. Noble said, that I appreciate the fact that you're taking a look at this program and saying it is deficient, and I think you've got some good plans to move this forward. So I really highly encourage you to do that and to come back to our committee and let us know how we can help in that direction. So I appreciate that. But can you give me an idea of the difference between our oversight of the gaming compact versus what we do at Canterbury Park and at Running Aces? Because my understanding is we have on-site inspectors at Running Aces and at Canterbury Park, at least when we're horse racing. Is that correct?
Director Cook.
Mr. Chair, representatives, what we AGE does, we do work with the card rooms, we do work with the Racing Commission. To say that my staff are there on site during racing would not be accurate. We do work with them when they have a report of a card sheet or something that they need investigated. They contact us, we respond, we do take action, but we do not have on-site presence at all times.
Then I would like to retract my one more question, Dave and Mr. Chair. So when I visited, I guess Running Aces is the visit I'm recalling, there were on-site people there from the state. Who would that be from then if it's not your group?
Director Tucker.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my guess is there's two entities there. There are actually security personnel for the card rooms, and they, I believe, are overseen by the Minnesota Racing Commission, who manages those card rooms. So there is another layer of security and surveillance personnel. They're just not part of alcohol and gambling enforcement.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could we sandwich in Representative Kreisel? You had had a question before on the list for Director Tucker, I believe. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Tucker, I appreciate you coming here today. And it's obvious that what we're doing isn't working. We're drawing a lot of comparisons to Wisconsin, but we have to be cognizant of the fact that we have a $150,000 budget. As much as we don't want to be increasing funding, I think our public deserves better. And if we're really, I know when I go and go to the gas pump and fill up my tank, I see the sticker on there saying it's been inspected, I can be confident that I'm getting the fuel in my tank that I'm actually paying for. And that's the issue here. I don't think we're accusing anybody of cheating. We're not accusing the tribes or the casinos of cheating. But the public needs to have that confidence that what they're paying for, the service, the entertainment that they're paying for, is accurate. So if we're going to open up this can of worms, I think we need to be mindful of the fact that we might have to look at, at least I would be willing to look at the fact that we're going to have to change some things. If that's increasing a little bit of funding or figuring out getting more people, within the realm of the compact, we're going to have to do that. I don't know if it's something worth looking at, putting this under, putting the gaming enforcement portion of this under the Minnesota Gaming Control Board, if that's a way to make this more efficient. But it's something that we're really going to have to be considerate of, and I think work closely with you guys to figure out what we can do to help, because this isn't working, and we need to get it squared away as fast as possible. So I guess it wasn't so much a question, Mr. Chair, but a comment, sort of my thoughts on it.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Representative Creasel. Representative McDonald, followed by Representative Duffier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one comment in regards to the fee that is paid. The data in front of me is $150,000 annually with no escalator factor or inflation factor, so it's permanent at that point. So once, hopefully, we come to a conclusion and get this settled and we start inspecting, we'll need to know the cost of it. If it does cost the state more to do the proper inspections, which should have been done in the first place, matter of fact, stating Commissioner Ellingson said that they had a $100,000 decrease in their budget, but yet, as I read, we collect $150,000 to do the inspections, although it's blackjack, but that wasn't done either, so there's no excuse there, with all due respect. So I think we'll need to know, once we do the inspections correctly, the cost of it. And if it is more than $150,000, then that has to come somewhere out of our taxpayers' pockets, or we'll have to increase that funding or that fee. I don't know what the compact says with Governor Carlson regarding the fee, but I would hope that we'll come to a logical conclusion to increase the fee if that costs us more. And I want to ensure that data is presented to us and that we have an opportunity to ensure that the fee is properly paid for the expense. Does that make sense?
Does to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, it does. Part of the strategic planning should incorporate, there's a number of things I need to look at, and I think we do need to figure out what does everything cost? What's the price attached to it? We need to know what that is. It's no different than your household checkbook. You have to figure out how you're going to pay all your bills, and we need to figure out what they are. And I just wanted to offer up, Mr. Chair, I did bring a very competent agent that does the inspections. I know you got a little bit into the technical questions about it. I know you're kind of short on time. We can certainly stay around, or if you would like us back at some time in the future, I would be more than happy to come back as well.
I think we will probably hold that for an additional time. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And mine is more of a comment. I guess I'm amazed at all this concern when there's no case of fraud. There's no evidence that the tribes are swindling people. And I think some of my colleagues have forgotten that the tribes are sovereign nations and sovereign governments, and that they have a compact with the state of Minnesota. And I think my colleagues have also forgotten that as a sovereign nation, they regulate themselves, and then they subject themselves to federal regulation. This is one of the most regulated industries in the state of Minnesota. And to cry, oh, we got to do more, we got to put stickers on like somebody's ripping us off. Not true. What the tribes have done is use gambling as their form of revenue. And they have lifted thousands of people out of poverty. They employ 26,000 people. And I think we need to be very careful about what slope we're going to go down here. Because we're in search of a problem. And maybe we need to start looking a little closer at Racino and card clubs. Maybe that's what we need to do.
Representative Gauthier, thank you for your scolding there, but I think that is better placed on the media today. I think the questions have been very respectful, not pointing fingers. We even said that it wasn't Director Tuckner's fault here. The media might have been making a big hullabaloo about this, but I think everything's gone well today. I think overall, it's hard to find fraud when there's no inspections. So that's one of the problems we got. The other thing is we negotiated a pretty crummy compact. I think everybody knows that for today's modern standards. But it's not like the Constitution where we can make amendments. We're stuck with it, and we have to deal with it. And then the perception sometimes is reality. I think the tribal and gaming people have to be aware that we don't know how much money that they bring in. All we know is it's in the billions. There's no specific amount. And when you have that kind of money flowing into an organization and you have a lack of inspections, that naturally makes the reaction we're getting. And nobody here, I think, is accusing the tribal communities of fleecing anybody. But we just like to commend your inspections along with Racino and the other places. We just like a commensurate amount of inspections for the Indian and gaming community.
Well, Mr. Chair, just in response, you know, that's their money. It's a sovereign government. And if they choose to reveal that to us, so be it. But that's their right. So we need to be careful, is all I'm saying. We need to be careful where we're going here. We have an agreement. Unfortunately, you know, Governor Perpich and Governor Carlson signed these compacts. They're open-ended, and they limit the role of the state. And I think those were consciously done that way in recognition of the sovereignty, and we need to respect that.
It's their money. Yes, it used to be ours, like banks.
You can choose not to go.
It's their money, the banks, true, but it used to be ours. We have to have some regulation and inspections, and I think that's what we're after. But Representative Leidiger, let's probably just trade it off question for question here. Go ahead, and then we'll move to the next question, just so we get everybody an opportunity to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I have a comment, actually, not a question, and that is that, you know, we're here to protect the interests of the people of the state of Minnesota. And nobody's accusing anybody of anything. But if you ignore a huge portion of what's going on in terms of the commerce, that's possibly a $40 billion industry, the gambling industry here, if you totally ignore it, anything can happen. And I've tried to lay the groundwork of what could conceivably happen when you're talking about these electronic machines and the variation in returns without really the public knowing anything about this. And then for the lack of any kind of inspection at all just opens the door for problems. And the public is out there, and you're looking at all the press that this has gotten, they're very concerned. And what's very interesting is that the tribes themselves, when asked, gee, what if Racino would get passed and you'd start having competition within the gaming industry, their own words are, well, you know, we'll have to become more competitive and pay out greater returns. These are their words. They can change payouts.
That's right.
And that's how they would react to competition. So these are issues that need to be put to the forefront and make sure that people understand what's going on. It's a huge industry, and it's growing. And the amount of dollars that you receive now from the tribes is $150,000. Well, has that changed over the many, many years? Yet we know that the gaming industry has quadrupled in just so many years.
Thank you, Representative Leidiger. And Representative Draskowski, did you want to say anything or address anything that? Oh, Mr. Nobles, did you want to comment?
I'll free up my seat for anyone else who would like to sit here, but I just want to conclude by saying, as you fill out your understanding of how these casinos are regulated, I think it would be appropriate if you bring forth some of the federal officials that are involved. I know when we did our evaluation and looked at what was being done by the state through the Department of Public Safety, it really was necessary for us to also understand what is being done by federal officials. In fact, as a part of our investigation or evaluation, we had a meeting with the U.S. Attorney at the time, Tom Heffelfinger, and other federal officials to get a full understanding of just how much inspection and oversight exists of the casinos, and frankly, in general with gambling, even where there is a stronger state presence, such as at the racetrack or with the lottery, there is still also, though it may not always be as visible, there is always a federal presence in any form of gambling that exists. because it is potentially, it is a large industry, as you say, but it is also an industry, unfortunately, that at times across the board in any form of gambling, whether it's horse racing, lotteries, or casinos, that can be subject to inappropriate activities, shall we say. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm only suggesting, and I'd be happy to try to help facilitate that, that we have present in the future some of the federal officials to see what they're doing to protect the public.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. And it's interesting, you've seen the horrific amount of paperwork and the inquisition into the use of the legacy dollars, a fraction of the amount of money that goes through the casinos, and all the speculation and consternation about our legacy money. It seems only fitting that an organization that huge surpasses that in a total amount of dollars taken in should get the same speculation. But Representative Drazkowski, you've done some research into this, and I would like your reflection on what you thought of the testimony today, where your questions answered that you had about this, and what you think needs to be done for a couple of minutes here. I'll give you about 3 minutes if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for allowing me to come before you today. And Mr. Chair, yes, I think we're heading in the right direction. So I really appreciate the discussion we've had today. I appreciate the leadership that Ms. Tuckner seems to be bringing to the division within the agency. No. Members, at least from the research I've done, if you extrapolate what is spent on gambling in Wisconsin's Indian casinos, our best guess at this point is about a $20 billion total bet industry, if you will, within in Minnesota. I don't think anybody knows what that number is, but it's a huge amount of money, and it's really incumbent upon us as leaders in this state to protect the integrity of that experience, as Representative Kreisel talked about earlier. That's our responsibility. As a matter of fact, it's the agreement that we reached in the compacts with the Indian tribes in the early 90s and in late 80s. So we actually have a mandate to make certain that these inspections continue, that they're done correctly. As I started to dig into this, Mr. Chair, I look back at some past inspection documents and looked at some of the trends and realized we have been collecting $150,000 every year according to the compact that's supposed to be used for inspections. Well, that has diminished in its use for that particular function over time. As a matter of fact, in the last year, as far as we can tell, there's been no inspections done, nor audits. There's three different categories that, according to the compact, we're supposed to be and have the ability to be involved in. One is financial audits, the other is inspecting the slot machines, and the third is inspecting the blackjack tables in that experience. So as we look across the river into Wisconsin, it was mentioned they've got about 15 FTEs over there covering less casinos than we have here, and we've got, at least on paper, we're supposed to have three or four FTEs, but it seems, again, they're not doing inspections. So again, thank you, Ms. Tuckner, for that leadership. One contrast, quickly in departing, Mr. Chair, I see you looking at the clock. We look at what is happening right now with some of the regulation at both Running Aces and Canterbury. And for what they have there now, the regulation costs them about $1.6 million per year right now. And that doesn't include the other inspection. I looked at, Mr. Chair, at the fiscal note for Representative Hackbar's bill, and the suggestion from the department was, if we were going to do a Racino at those two locations, we should have about 10 FTEs to do that at a cost of about $1.6 or $1.8 million per year. So if in the past the department has believed that it's that important to have that happen, I think we need to have that same emphasis with the tribal Indian casinos and do what we can to make sure that we are maintaining that that integrity of that experience for Minnesotans. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Representative Drazkowski. I think we'll probably bring our hearing to a close here with the announcement that the committee consideration of public safety bonding request, we're going to move to Thursday, February 9th, and then your save folders in your, if you could purge those and file some of those up in your office, your save folder is getting awful big, and maybe you could take that with you or as much as you could. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.